Thought Leadership from PwC.
Welcome to PwC's Accounting Podcast. I'm Heather Horn. Thanks for joining me for the next episode in our year-end toolkit series, a series of episodes designed to help you through the year-end close. And even if you're not currently in year-end, don't change the channel. This information is relevant no matter when your year-end occurs, and some of this advice may even help you get ahead in your process. Today's focus, income taxes. From valuation allowances to the tax effects of goodwill impairments to tax law changes and new regulations in the U.S. and abroad, we'll make sure you're up to speed.
I cannot stress the importance of having a process where you are staying in front of these developments.
That was my guest, PwC tax specialist Jen Spang, who's here to share her wealth of experience advising clients on income tax accounting. So stay tuned to be prepared for this year end. And with that, let's get started. So Jen, Happy New Year and welcome to the podcast. And this month's podcast series is all about year-end reporting, of course, of which tax is a very important part. And in particular, I know there's been no shortage of tax law changes this year and some other standard-setting activity. But before we get into some of those details, I always like to start off just by asking you your top year-end reminders.
Yeah, it's a great place to start considering where we are. I would say there are really three things that I spend the most time talking about right now, and tax law changes are one of them. So I know we'll talk a little bit about that while we're together. But before we go there, valuation allowance considerations. You know, this is the assessment of the realizability of deferred tax assets. It is nothing unique to year end. It is a continuous assessment. But the reality is we see a lot of activity just under normal circumstances in the fourth quarter. And this year, we have just seen a lot of activity through the whole year, and it's not letting up for the fourth quarter. So when you think about interest rates and the rising interest rates there, that has continued to put pressure on being able to deduct interest. As you and I have talked about before, There were changes that were enacted back in 2017 that limit interest deductibility, or I should say broaden the limitation. But part of that change in tax law, so already being limited, was a deferred effective date in going on a limitation from EBITDA to EBIT. And that change took place this year. And so you've got these rising interest rates, plus you've got this effective now change from EBITDA to EBIT. And when you take that all together, that's put a much more significant limitation on interest, which then drives questions of realizability on those carry forwards. So you've got those dynamics. You also just have the impact of interest that it impacts investments when you're thinking about unrealized losses around these available for sale securities. All of that activity is also bringing in valuation allowances in industries that, you know, don't always have to think about it. So just in general, that is a big, big year-end topic, I would say, right now.
Let me ask a question, because I know this change in from EBITDA to EBIT has come up in a few other places. And just want to make sure I understand. So this relates to one of the interest deductions, is that right? Can you just give us a little bit more background?
Yeah, absolutely. So using the code reference, 163J is the actual IRS code reference. But basically, that causes you to do a calculation to get to a taxable income number that will then impact how much interest you can get to deduct. And until this year, that was based on EBITDA. So think about that, you know, obviously earnings without consideration of your depreciation and amortization deductions. But effective in 2022, the limitation is based on just EBIT. So now you're reducing that earnings start by your depreciation and amortization. And as a result, your starting point is lower. So hopefully that, I don't know if that gave a better explanation.
Yeah, very helpful, especially since it did happen 5 years ago. So I'm sure tax professionals have been focused, but for some of the rest of us, many, many other things have happened in the past 5 years. So,
yeah, well, and there was a fair bit of, there was another area that you and I talked about just before year end, but capitalization of R&D that our listeners might have been very focused on. This was also enacted in 2017, but with a delayed effective date, which kicked in this calendar year. So companies have been dealing with that all year where mm-hmm. they've had to capitalize R&D. And then depending on whether it's domestic or foreign R&D, the spread is either 5 or 15 years. But we had been anxiously awaiting a year-end tax package that might have deferred that change such that there maybe wouldn't have been capitalization for 2022. But that did not happen. So these delayed effective dates, you know, 2022 became kind of a big year of change for companies. And that's all coming to a head as you sit with a year-end audit, really.
All right. Very helpful. So then that was reminder one. I think I can guess reminder two, but let's see what your next area of focus for year end.
The other one is goodwill. And I'm going to guess you were guessing yes. that it is the other area again, especially this year. Again, goodwill impairment assessments, you're doing it. It's not abnormal, but particularly this year, as we look at interest rates and all of the other dynamics that are happening in the economy, goodwill impairments, just on a broader basis, have been an area of focus. The reason it comes up for me is because, of course, you have tax accounting impacts once you conclude on an impairment. There can be impacts to deferreds. But importantly, sometimes people miss that taxes themselves can actually impact whether you have an impairment and then how much. And so when I think about that, there is just such an important, you just cannot emphasize enough how important it is to make sure that tax is at the table mm-hmm. in doing those assessments. And then there's a particular nuanced, and I think you and Beth talked about this on an earlier podcast, but there is also a nuance based on some changes in rules that happened some time ago. But where if you have tax deductible goodwill, you actually also have to break out potentially your algebra hat, which I mean, I know I get excited about that.
Exactly. Not. Who knew that accounting actually involved math?
I know, right? But you get into this situation where if you start impairing the goodwill, because when you're looking at what is your book value, deferreds are a part of that. You start impairing goodwill, it changes your deferred, therefore your book value changes, and around in a circle you go. And to solve that, what the standard says is you need to do something called a simultaneous equation. And essentially that will solve for what your impairment is and what your deferreds are. So again, just a really important thing. It's something that it sometimes can be very simple, but in other times when you're mixing in with a valuation allowance, it can get very complicated very quickly. And definitely another area where we want people to be teaming together to figure that out.
All right. Well, I think probably your overall reminder could have just been make sure tax and accounting are working together. But with that said, then let's move then to some of these tax law changes, because I know there's been a lot happening. Obviously, we had some things in the U.S. earlier in the year, but then a lot around the globe as well.
Absolutely. So, you know, at a high level, there was some guidance released in November. I shouldn't say some guidance. There was proposed regulations that amended some final regulations that were issued in the foreign tax credit space. That's been an area companies are very focused on, and they were looking for some of that guidance, hoping for some relief. I think they got some relief and in other cases not. But at the end of the day, that guidance is very important and came in through the fourth quarter and is likely to impact companies' assessments of uncertain tax positions. And importantly, those proposed regs, just as a level setting from an accounting perspective, proposed regs are a little bit different than, let's say, when you have an exposure draft from an accounting sense, like if you think about it in those buckets, because proposed regulations, the government will sometimes have reliance language in the proposed regs. So even though they're not final yet, a taxpayer can rely on them. So it is, no matter what, a new piece of information. You have to think about whether you're going to follow those proposed regs or not. And then depending upon your decision making, you'll have to sort if it has an impact on your accounting today. Importantly, these proposed regs are actually effective for tax years beginning after December 31st, 2019. So not only are we looking at it prospectively, but you've got to think about those positions that you took prior as a result of the other regs. So the foreign tax credit regs, companies are definitely spending time talking about, have been for months, but clearly as they go through year end. Inflation Reduction Act was obviously a big event in 2022, not a significant amount of accounting in 22 per se, but clearly going to impact as you're thinking about that earnings guidance and as you think about what that's going to look like in 2023. So companies are going to be spending time on that for during year end, just as part of that process. And then the last one, and this is one that probably more questions in this exact moment while we're taping than answers, but that deals with Pillar Two. So had we taped this before the end, I'd say, by the second week of December, what I would have just said is Pillar Two continues to be an evolving area. We expect activity in 2023. It's something companies need to be thinking about and monitoring. But unfortunately, we actually did see some activity in 2022. So I will simply do a quick hit on these. Definitely, more to look into, including from an accounting perspective. But Japan actually released its Pillar 2 guidance. Now, in that case, it is not enacted, nor when you look at it from an IFRS lens, is it substantively enacted. So that looks like they think it's going to be in March of this year. So that looks like it's going to be a Q1 event. South Korea. Also, I'm going to use the word passed some legislation that there is a question as to whether it is enacted or not. That legislation had rate changes in it, which appears to have gone through the full process, but it also, the same package has some Pillar 2 guidance in it, but it's not complete. So there is actually a question as to whether we have either substantive enactment, if you're from an IFRS lens, or enactment from a US GAAP lens. And I wish I had the answer today, but people are still analyzing the law for that. To the extent there was enactment, then that could potentially be a 22 event and how to think about accounting around that. And then the last one I'll mention is UAE. Historically, UAE has not had a corporate income tax regime, but in 2022, it sounds they did pass some legislation to incorporate one. It looks like companies will be subject to either a 0% or a 9% rate, but apparently there is not guidance on when the 0 or the 9 would actually apply, which makes it, of course, difficult to actually implement. So the question here is what, if anything is the impact. We understand there is another step expected where that guidance will develop. I would just also note, while this is not Pillar 2, right, this is the incorporation of a corporate tax rate, one can reasonably suspect that it is prompted by the Pillar 2 movements and, bringing in a corporate income tax rate.
Let me ask a question, because to remind our listeners, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Pillar 2, I'm going to say simplistically, requires a 15% minimum tax. And I know there's way more to it, but how does 9% in the UAE then even fit in from that point of view?
It's a great question. And it doesn't, because it's not 15, okay. Right? So, you're right. It Pillar 2 aims for a minimum tax of 15%. So it's unclear. It's clear that going from 0 to 9 is like you're trying to move the needle closer to that global minimum tax. But it clearly didn't get you to 15. So good question. No real answer per se. Also not really sure why that partly needed to be done before December 31st. So a lot more questions.
Yeah, definitely. All right, well, go on. I just, like I said, wanted to make sure that I was grounding all of us in where we started with Pillar 2. So it sounds like more to come. So
more to come. Yeah. So from there, the only other thing I was going to mention in Pillar 2 is the EU. So prior to December 31st, actually like that third week in December, the EU did get unanimous consent to move forward with Pillar 2. And so just for a little bit of grounding there, all of the member states did need to agree. There had been Poland had withheld its agreement and then did agree, and then Hungary withheld it. So there had been some movements around that. So everybody agreed prior to the end of the year. That then prompted the EU issued a directive having member states go off and implement the law. the most important thing for this discussion is that is not a change in tax law. So while this is agreement, and while the EU directive has been released and is effective, changes in tax law aren't complete with the EU directive. The member states each have to go and implement their own changes in tax law based upon their own local jurisdiction law. So Germany has to go, France has to go, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody has to go implement their own. But what that does mean is the gates have been opened, right? So we've been talking about this for a while. So now Japan is on the cusp. The UK has been on the cusp. South Korea might even be there. And then you've got the EU going there. And according to the directive, they should be implementing in 2023. So I guess the message there is we can expect in Q1 and for the entirety of the year, probably a fair bit of activity around these changes in tax law that are going to make things pretty interesting, complicated. I guess it depends on your perspective.
Yes. And I would just say, I guess, for the listener's point of view, particularly if you have operations in those countries that Jen just mentioned, this can get very complicated very quickly. And Jen and her team did put out an In the Loop that talks about some of the subtleties related to this. And I would highly recommend, if you are potentially impacted by any of this, that you start studying that now, because it is not something that's very easy and quick to understand, you know, as soon as you pick it up.
Yeah. And importantly, once one country goes, you know, the reality is the way these rules work, everybody will go, because if you don't have these rules in place, somebody else can take that tax that might be generated by your home country. So again, a lot of activity there. So that's it. I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, and definitely that was the piece that stood out for me as well, that the really, I think, important piece to understand there. And again, if we go back to you talking about the Inflation Reduction Act, which I have some follow-up questions, and you mentioning that companies are thinking about that from a planning perspective, clearly some of these other changes as well are going to be important as companies are doing their 2023 planning.
Absolutely.
All right. So then, anything else for year end? Otherwise, I do want to talk about Inflation Reduction Act in a little more detail.
No, I think those are the big year end things that are happening and are on top of mind for most people. Yeah.
Perfect.
In the tax world, recognizing that's only one world.
That's okay. That's the focus of this podcast. We have to give, you know, our tax brethren equal billing. So then, specific to the Inflation Reduction Act, because this has a big impact on power utilities industry, which, as many of our regular listeners will know, that's the industry I come from. I've definitely been getting a lot of questions. And Jen, I know many, many more. So much more so for you, since you're actually a tax specialist, lots of questions about the IRA and what it means for 2023. So what are some of the things that are top of mind?
So again, I seem to be focused on threes today. So I'll give you three hits. Two of them around developments around the accounting that came through technical inquiries with the FASB. So the first on the minimum tax. From a minimum tax perspective, GAAP actually gives guidance on how to account for a minimum tax. So when we look at the corporate alternative minimum tax, that came into play, not to be confused with Pillar 2, even though it's a 15% minimum tax, it is not compliant with the model rules for Pillar 2. But for the US, this 15% minimum tax. When you look at US GAAP basically says you measure your deferred taxes using your regular tax rate, which means that even if you expect to be a minimum taxpayer forever, you don't measure your deferreds at the 15%. You keep them at our federal, you know, 21 without talking about state. The second thing it provides is the minimum tax, when you pay it, becomes a credit carry forward. And so GAAP tells you to record a deferred tax asset. And then the last thing that GAAP tells you is you then assess that deferred tax asset for realizability. So the question you might say is, well, what was confusing then when CAMT came in? And that really had to do with the realizability back on that valuation allowance. It comes up a lot. The realizability of your non-min tax deferred carry forward, right? So your all of your other deferred taxes, think about, you know, your R&D credit carry forwards or anything like that. And really the question here is, when you think about it, if you are a minimum taxpayer, when those deferreds reverse And you were minimum tax. Essentially, those deferreds are just reversing into a new deferred for the min tax that you just paid. And so you have a classic case of substitution. Under old U.S. law, old U.S. AMT that existed up until 2017, from an accounting perspective, you absolutely would have assessed or considered that future minimum tax status in assessing realizability of your current deferred taxes. But because of some guidance that came out around BEAT, there became a question as to whether that was still the case for this new minimum tax. Ultimately, what the FASB concluded is that, or what the FASB believes, is that it's not clear. GAAP is not clear. And so companies need to make a policy choice. Now, I mentioned changes in tax law get accounted for in the period of enactment. That date has gone for this. But I think what's really important is for some companies, it didn't actually matter when IRA was actually enacted. But your facts could develop such that that wasn't even on the table for you, but it becomes in the future. So until a policy choice is made, either consciously or by accident, you would need to be thinking about that. And so I just stress that that's something companies want to just keep on the radar. The second area, and I know this one's near and dear to your heart, are credits. So IRA introduced or expanded or changed a whole number of credits, particularly in that climate space, if you will. So there are some credits that are refundable. They're called, in this case, direct pay credits. There's a pretty good traveling around what the accounting model is there. When you have credits that you can monetize without any connection to your taxable income, those would be accounted for outside of income taxes. So they'd be accounted in pre-tax. There are some of those in IRA, but there are really only three in the IRA that are broadly applicable. Some of the other ones are pretty narrow populations that could have them. However, IRA introduced a whole slew of transferable credits. And for the most part, those credits can be transferred once and only once. There is no tax on the transfer. So there's no tax on any kind of gain or anything like that. But the buyer of the credit has the only way to monetize for the buyer is through having taxable income. So the question became, how do you account for transferable credits? We've had transferable credits before, but not as broadly and at the magnitude, I would say, that that IRA introduced. So through technical inquiry with the FASB, there were sort of three paths pursued. Should it be accounted for on the tax line? Should it be something that's similar to refundable credits should be accounted for in pre-tax? Or should there be some kind of model that's really a reflection of the economics? Meaning, if I, let's say, am a loss company, there's no way for me to monetize the credits except through sale. Should that be the driver of my accounting, like the real economics of my facts? Ultimately, the FASB believed that the most appropriate accounting is to account for them on the tax line. And then to the extent you have a transfer or sale, you would record any gain or loss, in this case, probably a loss, on the tax line as well. In practice, I think that's raising a lot of questions. A lot of companies that already have refundable credits really are looking at it saying through their lens, this is just like a refundable credit. And the FASB did acknowledge that GAAP is unclear, and so other alternatives might be acceptable. So I think we're going to continue to see that space evolve in 2023, Heather, and I think you're going to see a fair bit of diversity around that. Maybe just one thing to just mention is back on that whole, new guidance thing. There was guidance issued by the Treasury and the IRS over the last week of the year in both the CAMT space and then on the excise tax, which I know we haven't talked about, but just be aware that from a tax law development, those pieces of guidance, they answer some questions, they raise some new questions, and they don't answer all of the questions. But that guidance did get released, so companies will be thinking about that as they head into 2023.
All right. So I'm not going to delve into the accounting because I think the answers you gave were fairly clear, even if people may have different views on what that may look like in practice. But I do have actually two sort of policy questions that we don't have to go too deep into, but I have to first ask, you said the 15% CAMT is not the same as the 15% in Pillar 2, and yet they're both minimum taxes. So is there a simple reason that those are different?
No.
Okay, so that's a whole other podcast that we need to talk about.
That could be a whole other podcast. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, neither the U.S. GILTI, which is actually what would be more akin to Pillar 2, neither the GILTI, that global intangible low tax income that we've been talking about for years. So neither GILTI nor the CMT are what we'd say Pillar 2 compliant. They don't comply with it, you know, GILTI because it's not based on book income as one reason. There's a whole host of reasons. And then the CAMT, while it's based on financial statement income, it doesn't have the same characters and attributes that the model rules set out. And therefore, some of the interactions with credits and things, and therefore, it is also not a Pillar 2 compliant regime. I think the interesting question is, as you see all of these countries begin to implement the model rules, you have to imagine, and maybe this is a future podcast that we could jump on with Pat and I, but you have to imagine from a US perspective, somebody else can take that revenue if we don't have compliant rules. So there's a lot to unfold from a policy perspective yet to come when you think about it through the US lens.
Yes, I almost mentioned Pat when I said I was going to ask this question. So I do think it'd be nice to have you guys both back to talk about policy. The other one may be equally complicated, but I'm also curious, is you mentioned that some of these IRA tax credits are refundable. So you can, you know, turn them in for cash. You don't have to have any income taxes. Others are transferable. Now, why? Like, why didn't they just make them all, you know, refundable? Or why didn't they just say you have to get them through the tax line? Is there a tax policy reason for this? Or is it, again, way beyond the scope of something you can answer in a couple of minutes?
Yeah, definitely one that would be outside my area. I don't know that there is a single policy answer for it, actually just very broadly. But I think probably a question that is another good Pat Brown question. So maybe we could hit on that as well.
Perfect.
Because there's probably in each case, depending upon who the target was, could dictate how that was structured, as well as what did or didn't exist from the past. So I think there, you know, are probably a number of factors that go into that from a policy perspective.
Perfect. Teaser for an upcoming podcast then. So thank you for indulging me on that. Now, I have another question for you, though, something that was very big that happened from a standard setting perspective in December. A lot of interest, I think it's started in December, maybe November, but you can fill us in terms of we are actually seeing some movement now from the FASB in terms of some of its disclosure requirements. So what can you share there?
Yeah, very big development for a project that's been around for a while. And I won't go back to this spring sort of because that's when we saw it pick back up. And it just suffice to say moved very quickly from the spring to November. And you were right in going back to November. So the board has concluded to move forward with an exposure draft. We expect to see that exposure draft in the first quarter. They expect it to have a 75-day comment period. And the changes that I'll hit the big ones are really in two areas, cash taxes paid and then the rate rec. So what they'll expose in the cash taxes paid area is there will be a quarterly disclosure of cash taxes paid broken into federal, foreign, and state. So federal, state, foreign, just those three categories on a quarterly basis. And then annually, you will have an incremental disclosure where you'll break that further by jurisdiction. And that breakout will be based upon, in the exposure draft, 5% of cash taxes paid. So there'll be a further disaggregation, but it's that further disaggregation is at year end or in the annual financials. The other thing that they did decide is that the disclosure is based upon net, or it's net of refunds. But importantly, when you're looking at the disclosure, you're not just going to net it, and it's going to be on a, I guess you could say an absolute value, I guess. We'll have to see what the words say, but it's not like if I have a $100 payable and a $100 refund that I have no disclosure because I'm at zero. It's going to be on the 100. So that's cash taxes paid, at least the big ones. For rate reconciliation, that the focus was incremental improvements. So what they decided is to pursue both a categories approach and a quantitative approach. So there are 8 categories that are required. This has been something that evolved. So importantly, that is not based on a quantitative threshold. Everybody will disclose those 8 categories. Then the quantitative disclosure will come in, where within certain of those categories, you will break them down and disaggregate based upon this 5% rule. So we often call it the SEC 5% rule, because that's where you find the rule. So that's just, you are today required to disclose any item that's over 5% of your domestic rate. So in the US, for a US multinational, that's around 1%, right? 5% of 21. So that same rule will be codified, and then you will disaggregate within the categories. Now, just a quick note on the foreign rate differential one, a really important point is you will disaggregate for that line item on both a jurisdiction basis and a nature of item basis. So what does that mean? Essentially, it means you could have a jurisdiction that the rate differential is greater than that 5% of 21. So it's greater than the 1%. But let's just assume no individual item is for that jurisdiction over that 5% rule. So you would have a line item under your foreign rate category for jurisdiction A. But then let's imagine jurisdiction B has some significant item. So, you know, like a credit of some sort that is over the 5% rule. So in that category, you're going to have jurisdiction A, just a single line. Jurisdiction B is going to be there. And underneath that, you're going to have a foreign rate differential. And then you're going to have that credit. So that is what I mean by breakout by both jurisdiction and nature of item. So that's going to be something companies are going to want to really think through. How would you implement that? And what I'd always say is there's a comment period for a reason. So, you know, this is a time, whether individually or as part of a group, to be thinking about what matters, how does cost benefit, you know, anything you think is important, and to be sharing that point of view. So that's a rate rec. The other thing with the rate rec is today you can choose between percentage disclosing either by percentage or dollar. This exposure draft will propose that you will be required to disclose both the percentage and dollar. So you will be required to do your rate rec. So when you think about your 3 years under your rate rec, you're going to have 2 columns for each, and then you're going to have all those rows. There are a few other items in the project, but the key thing is there are some pretty big developments, and I think we can be sure we're going to be seeing a standard. So it's an important time to watch that and be engaged.
All right. So Jen, 2 follow-up questions for that. The first one I think is obvious, but I just want to make sure. So when you were giving your example, you said jurisdiction A, jurisdiction B. Now, when the companies are actually making these disclosures, those jurisdiction A and B will be actual countries or states or otherwise. Yes. So, because I think that's sometimes right. People will be like, oh, I don't actually have to put which one.
Oh, yeah.
Just,
no.
Yeah. So no. You're saying.
I was just trying not to pick a country.
Yes, exactly.
You know, but it would be like saying, you know, maybe Germany is just Germany. It's over the 5%, but no nature items are, if I'll call them that. But like Ireland has something that is both, you know, Ireland itself is the differential is over the 5% rule, but so is a particular item. So mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it, you'll be listing the actual jurisdiction that it's in.
All right. Then the other follow-up question is, I think one of the things that at least some people were surprised by is that the AICPA conference in December, the FASB did show a sample disclosure. Now, was it of both of these or just one? And any surprises when you saw that?
I would say no surprises. It was more confirmation. Having listened to the meeting, I would tell you it wasn't abundantly clear in their discussion about this foreign differential point that I just made, that it would be by jurisdiction mm-hmm. and by nature of item. But in the minutes that the FASB releases after they have this, in those minutes, it was very clear. Like it said, by jurisdiction and nature of item. And so the sample that they showed really does confirm that it will be as I just described. So I think not usually a surprise if you looked at the minutes, but I think it will be a challenge for companies. I think companies will be a bit surprised as to the level of work that goes into that. And as they begin to think about that.
And then I think you mentioned this, but now that you've talked about it, I think some of our listeners may be much more interested in the timing of this exposure draft. So it's just Q1, or do we have a better sense of when we may see something?
So they're trying, in their meeting, they said they're trying to navigate around recognizing the population that will be involved in responding to this is finance people, but also tax people. Mm. And, you know, there are multiple spring deadlines for tax people, right? So, so what they said is Q1, it sounds like their goal might be like late February. It won't be January. I would think at best it's late February, but kind of Q1 such that combined with that 75 days should allow companies to be able to navigate around year end, Q1 and tax deadlines. So don't have a specific month, but it sounds like, you know, February at the earliest, and I would guess like late February if February.
All right. So definitely sounds like if you are potentially impacted by this, which most companies will be in some way, that now you may want to start looking at the minutes and look at some of these examples now. So it's not, you know, you're at least a little ahead when this comes out. So, and definitely we'll announce this in the newsletter. And I'm sure perhaps you should already book now our first quarter accounting webcast, Jen, for March, because it sounds like we may be talking about it then. So, all right. So Jen, then final wrap up. You've had a lot of different points and I think a lot of takeaways for people. If they've been listening, they might have been jotting down some notes here. But any final advice for our listeners, you know, just as we look at all of the different things going on from a tax perspective?
Well, I think we've hit on some of them. And just before I do final wrap up, just know the ISB also has some standard setting where we expect to see an exposure draft in January that deals with Pillar 2. So maybe just a second on that. The ISB is, they have decided to expose, so it has to go through the process, but a temporary but mandatory exception to accounting for deferred taxes around Pillar 2. So what that basically means is that once that became a standard, you would essentially know that for some period of time, and this is a temporary, but there isn't a time frame given. Mm-hmm. It's temporary until the board either makes it permanent or removes it. You would be accounting for the impact of Pillar 2 as a period item. And I suspect we'll have more conversation as to where we're going in US GAAP around that, mm-hmm. as that's continuing to evolve as well. So that ties in with my wrap up in that I would say we've already talked about so many areas and what's to come. I cannot stress the importance of having a process where you are staying in front of these developments, because we talked about changes in tax law are accounted for in the period of enactment. Assessment of uncertain tax positions and new information, that's in the period in which that information is available. So when you think about those things, like you don't have long to deal with something when it happens. And so it's so important to be in front of each of these developments and all that is to come and how it will evolve with additional guidance interpreting even laws that are changing. So just the staying informed, staying in front of is a big one. We hit already on the need to collaborate, so I won't dive too deep on that, but just it's obvious they're across every area we've talked about. And then last but not least, and very appropriate as we think about year end, is transparency. Mm-hmm. And so that's really around disclosure. You know, a lot of these, some of these are not changes in tax law, but do they rise to that MD&A risk factor? Sure. You know, this is the stuff that we want to be thinking about. How do you need to address the changes that are happening that are right on the corner? You know, how do you think about that in a transparent way, giving good transparency to the users of your financial statements?
All right. Well, Jen, definitely a lot to talk about and appreciate all the updates and look forward to continuing our conversation. Sounds like you will be a regular guest in 2023. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. Tune in next week for more fresh episodes.
so that you never miss any of our audio content, follow the PwC Accounting Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. And to stay up to date on all our latest accounting and reporting news, sign up for our newsletter at viewpoint.pwc.com. From thought leadership at PwC, I'm Heather Horn. Thanks for tuning in.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates, and they sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.